So like I said, the last several weeks we've been talking on promise, and when last we looked at the Israelites, last week we went and we looked into the New Testament a little bit and looked at some promise in the New Testament, but when last we left off with the Israelites in the Old Testament, they had just crossed over the Jordan River and were standing in the edge of the promised land. They now had to face those enemies, those people living in the land that they had been so fearful of. So now today we're going to jump ahead a little bit, both in time and in Scripture, to see how the story ends. Because remember, this is all about living in the promises that God had for them. And so today we want to look at the longevity of living in that promise. In other words, how long were they able to remain in promise? How long were they able to remain in this promise that God had given them? And so to do that, we're going to jump ahead to the book of Judges, and we're going to look at a couple passages in the book of Judges. I'm going to start in chapter 2 of Judges. I will briefly recap kind of what's in chapter 1 as we get to that. But Judges chapter 2, starting in verse 1, says, "The angel of the Lord went up from Gilgal to Bochim and said, 'I brought you up out of Egypt and led you into the land, and I swore to your forefathers, into the land that I swore to your forefathers. I said, I will break my covenant. I will never break my covenant with you, and you shall not make a covenant with the people of this land, but you shall break down their altars. Yet you have disobeyed me. Why have you done this? Now therefore I tell you that I will not drive them out before you. They will be thorns in your sides, and their gods will be a snare to you.' When the angel of the Lord had spoken these things to all the Israelites, the people wept aloud, and they called that place Bochim. There they offered sacrifices to the Lord." Now, in verse 1, the angel of the Lord comes and appears to them. Remember back in Exodus 23:20 that we looked at several weeks ago, the Lord promised to send them an angel to guide them. And in Exodus 23:20, it says this, "See, I am sending an angel ahead of you to guard you along the way and to bring you to the place I have prepared for you." Well, I didn't look at it for the sake of time, but that angel first appeared in the book of Joshua that we started looking at several weeks ago. And here again, we see this angel that the Lord has promised way back in Exodus. But the angel comes to remind them of the promise. Throughout this entire series, we just keep seeing this over and over and over again. Despite the fact that the Israelites forget the promise, God is continually reminding them of the promise. And here, the angel reminds them of the promise. "I have brought you up out of Egypt. I'm leading you into the land that God swore to your forefathers." Verse 2, again, he continues to remind them of the promise, but now in verse 2, he reminds them of the conditions of the promise. In Exodus 23:24, again, that we looked at many weeks ago, God says this. And remember, in Exodus 23, this was a prophetic statement. God is speaking this way before they ever get to the promised land. But he's saying, when you get there, when you get to the promised land, he says, "Do not bow down before their gods, or worship them, or follow their practices. You must demolish them and break their stones to pieces." So that was what God had instructed them way back in Exodus. But here, now in Judges, the angel appears and says, "Guess what, guys? You failed. You didn't do this. You didn't complete the assignment that you had before you." Throughout chapter 1 here in Judges, it says that the Israelites failed to drive out the inhabitants of the land. And that was what God had instructed them to do. He told them to drive out the inhabitants and destroy all their sacred places, destroy all their gods, and they didn't do it. And throughout chapter 1 here in Judges, it's recounting that. In several of those incidences in chapter 1, it says that they simply failed to drive them out because they didn't even try. And in other places, they didn't drive them out because they were too powerful or too numerous. So in the cases of failing to even try, they disobeyed God and his commands. In the cases where they just couldn't overtake them, they failed to trust God and have faith. Because remember, he said that he would do it. Over and over and over again, he says, "I will do it. I will do it." But throughout chapter 1, we also see the Israelites try to come up with their own plan. And this is so important. You've got to get this. Throughout chapter 1, and I'm not going to read through it just for the sake of time, but it says that they forced all of these nations that they did not drive out, they forced them to become their slaves. And you think, okay, well, that's good, right? They didn't drive them out, but they made them slaves. Problem, God never told them to do this. God never told them, make them slaves. So why did they do it? Because it was easier. They took the easy way out. They were told to either kill them or drive them out completely of the land. So making the people slaves was just Israel's way of justifying their failures to obey God and do the hard things. Right? Well, the same holds true for us sometimes, doesn't it? God calls us to do a hard thing, and when we fail, or lack of obedience or lack of trust, we make an excuse and we look for an easier way. A way of our own understanding. And we're going to keep coming back to this, but they made them the slaves, which was an easier way out than to complete the assignment that God had given them of driving the people out of the land. Verse 3 here, the angel now tells them what the consequences of this disobedience are going to be. Because you failed, because you did not drive them out from the land, here is now what's going to happen. It says that they will be thorns to them. Now, the word thorn, probably in your Bible, it's in parentheses because it's implied in the Hebrew. The word thorns is not actually there. When you look at it in the Hebrew, it just says they're going to be in your side. So an expression that we might use today is they're going to be a pain in your neck. It just says these people that you did not drive out, they're going to be in your side. Now, remember, several times previously in this series, we've talked about how the people of the land were supposed to be provision. Remember when the spies came back, and they said, we can't do it. The people that live there are really big, and they're going to eat us alive. Joshua stands up and says, no, they will be bread for us. Remember that? And it was actually the word bread. Joshua sees them as provision, and then we saw that several other places where the people in the land were to be provision or bread. The Lord even says, I'm going to use the people living in the land to keep the land tillable so that when you arrive, it will produce crops for you. Okay? So the people in the land were supposed to be a blessing until the Israelites arrived, and then they were to drive them out. Or the angel of the Lord was going to drive them out, but the Israelites had to stand on guard. Well, now the angel says, well, these people that were supposed to be a blessing, they're going to be a thorn in your side. So what was supposed to be blessing has now become a curse. You know, I think God does that sometimes, doesn't he? He turns us over to our own vices. When we fail to receive blessing, when we fail to walk in promise, the Lord says, okay, fine, have it your way. And what was supposed to be a blessing or a promise becomes a curse to us. But what's really important here is in this last clause. Now, therefore, I tell you, I will not drive them out before you. They will be thorns in your sides, and their gods will be a snare to you. This is the sole reason God wanted the Israelites to drive out the inhabitants of the land. He's a jealous God, and he knows the dangers of worshiping false gods. So the fact that they were to drive them out was for the purpose that their gods would not remain as a snare. But now again, what was meant to be a blessing has become a curse. The angel of the Lord says, well, these gods are now going to become a snare to you. Here's the irony. God told them to either kill them or drive them out completely so that they would not be a temptation, so that their gods would not be a temptation. But by failing to do this and then making the people slaves to them, they have now entered into covenant with their greatest temptation. You see, slavery in this day and age was different than we understand slavery through the picture of American slavery, which was a complete atrocity. The slavery of this day is you entered into covenant with your slaves. And you basically said, we'll provide for you. We'll care for you. We'll protect you. We'll provide for you. We're the greater power. You're the lesser power. You work for us and we provide everything for you. It's covenant. They've now entered into covenant with what is their greatest temptation. So they're looking temptation in the eye and saying, well, I'm going to bless you. I'm going to take care of you. I'm going to feed you and I'm going to keep you near to me. Do you see the irony in that? They have taken what was to be their greatest temptation and they have now tied it around their neck as a millstone and promised to bless it. This is what has got them in this predicament. But the same holds true for us today. We have to be ruthless in eliminating temptation from our lives and not entering into it, not entering into covenant with it. You know, I was watching this Christian show on TV a night or two ago. And it was funny because the guy was kind of making the same point, and he talked about smartphones that have full internet access. And he talked about the staggering statistics of internet pornography, both for men and women. And he goes, when you walk around with this cell phone with full internet access in your breast pocket, you've just now entered into covenant with that. We have to be careful with what we saddle ourselves with around our neck, right? Okay, moving on. Picking up in verse 6. After Joshua had dismissed the Israelites, they went to take possession of the land, each to his own inheritance. Remember, they had divided up the land. Who was going to get what section? The people served the Lord throughout the lifetime of Joshua and of the elders who outlived him and who had seen all the great things the Lord had done for Israel. Joshua, son of Nun, the servant of the Lord, died at the age of 110. And then they buried him in the land of his inheritance at Timnath-Heres in the hill country of Ephraim, north of Mount Gaash. After that, the whole generation had been gathered to their fathers. Another generation grew up who knew neither the Lord nor what he had done for Israel. Then the Israelites did evil in the eyes of the Lord and served the Baals. They forsook the Lord, the God of their forefathers, who had brought them out of Egypt. They followed and worshipped various gods of the people around them. They provoked the Lord to anger. Because they forsook him and served the Baals and the Asherahs, in his anger against Israel, the Lord handed them over to raiders who plundered them. He sold them to their enemies all around, whom they were no longer able to resist. Whenever Israel went out to fight, the hand of the Lord was against them to defeat them, just as he had sworn to them. They were in great distress. So after verse 6, after the fighting is over, Joshua dismisses the people to go out to each to their own tract of land that they had been promised by Moses and the Lord. And then in verse 7, it says that throughout that entire time, when Joshua and the elders that he appointed, as long as they were alive, the people were faithful to serve the Lord. And it also mentions that the people who had seen the great things that God had done, the people that were there when they entered the promised land, when they were alive, they served the Lord. But then in verses 8 and 9, it says that this faithful and courageous leader, Joshua, dies. He's gathered to his people, and he dies. And then all of those who served with him, all of those elders that served with him, all of those that saw the great and mighty things that God had done, they all died. And when that generation had died, all of a sudden there's this incredible change in verse 10. It says that that whole next generation neither knew God nor the things that he had done. This whole next generation grew up not knowing the things of God. You see, there's a problem here, isn't there? The promise was for all time and all generations. And yet ultimately here in Judges chapter 2, verse 10, we see that the promise only lasted one generation. The generation that entered the promised land. And remember, it wasn't even promised to them, it was promised to their forefathers, but because of their forefathers' disobedience, they didn't even get to enter the promised land. Now, this generation enters the promised land, and the promise lasts for one generation. And then the promise ends. Well, that's not the way it's supposed to be. You know, the same holds true for us. Many of the promises that the Lord has given us are for all time and for all generations. And yet, frequently, they don't last. If you've studied revival at all, you know that revival only lasts one generation. Whoever the revival breaks out with, it ends with that generation. There's never been a revival in the history of the world that's lasted to the next generation. So we need to look at this failure closely to see what we can learn from it. And so I make a few observations here out of this whole scenario of how they failed. Number one, they failed to remember. We've talked about this over and over again, and I frequently do a message just on remembering. But if this next generation grew up and neither knew God nor the things that he did, they failed to remember. They must have never told the stories, or they didn't tell them often enough. That's why in the Vineyard it's so important that we share testimonies. It's so every week we try to have testimonies of God's faithfulness. Those of us who have been around a while, those of us that have seen God do amazing things, please hear me on this. Blame old age or failing memory, but tell your children over and over and over again about the faithfulness of God in your life. It's step one. I'll get back to step two in a minute. But we must remember the things that God has done. And we must tell those stories to anyone that'll listen. The second thing I see here is failing to pass it to the next generation. Failing to pass that baton. That's why revivals never last, because no one ever passes the baton. This generation didn't get to participate in the battles of their ancestor. This generation that now neither knows God nor the things he did, they were not the ones who took the land. They were not the ones who had the swords in their hands. They were not the ones that fought the battles. Okay? So at some point, you have to give them a battle. You have to hand the baton and give them a battle. At the National Conference of the Vineyard that we just attended, not this past week, but a week ago, like I had mentioned last week, there was 900 youth there at this conference. And at the National Conference, on the last night, Thursday night, we invited the 900 youth to come into the main auditorium, the main sanctuary with everybody, and we let the youth do all the praying. The adults weren't supposed to pray for anybody. This past week at Common Ground, we sent 6 youth to join with 100 other youth from the Chicagoland area. Guess what? They now have their own stories. It is our job to create these opportunities for them so that they have their own stories and encounters with God. That's what it looks like to hand the baton. When we hand the baton, it's not just telling them the stories of the good old days. And that's what kills revivals, is they just tell the stories of the good old days. There's a step two, part two to that. It's we have to hand the baton and say, okay, here, take these $1,500 water bottles and go out and hit the streets and pray for people, so that you come back with your own story, so that you have your own battle before you. We can't leave this to chance. We can't just assume that they will believe because we do. In the Israelites, maybe they just assumed that because they were now in the promised land that their children would believe. But it didn't happen. We're losing the youth generation at the highest rate in history because we just assume that our children will believe. Youth group and Common Ground are not just so that our youth have some activities to do. It is so that they can have their own encounters, their own experiences, and their own battles with God so that we can grow up a generation that does know God and does know his faithfulness and can tell their own stories. I sincerely hope that every story that I have ever told dies with me so that my children can tell their own stories of God's faithfulness. It's not, hey, remember when Dad, remember yesterday? When we prayed for that guy? And the third big thing that I see with what went wrong, with how they failed to remain in promise, is they didn't have a battle in front of them, and they failed to complete the last assignment. You see, they entered into the promised land, and almost immediately, they just kind of settled into a relative peace, a relative life of comfort. But it was somewhat of a false sense of peace, wasn't it? Because they had never finished the assignment that God had given them in driving out the people. So a big part of why they are in the place that they are in now with a generation that neither knows God nor his deeds is because the generation before never finished the assignment to drive out the people in the land. As a result, this younger generation has given in to the culture and gods around them. God said, you didn't drive them out, I'm going to make them a snare to you. And so this next generation has fully fallen into that snare of the culture and the gods of the people who weren't supposed to be there. And so what's happened? This generation now doesn't believe in God at all, or God is just one of many small g gods. But this generation here in Judges never had a battle in front of them. They quietly slipped into a comfortable life of ease, and they forgot about the promise. They were willing to settle for less than the fullness of the promises that God gave them because that is just easier. And then verses 11 through 15, these last 5 verses tell us that the next generation began to worship those gods of the people in the land. And as a result of this, God's anger burned against them, and they lost the promise. The promise was for just one generation. worse, in those last two verses, it says that the Lord is now against them. They've not only lost the promise, but the Lord is now against them. Wow, that's a tough place to be. But this promise was meant to be for all time. All right, so what does this have to do with us? Well, we've all been given promise. How do we remain in promise? The vineyard was born in revival. How do we remain in revival? We're reaching that point of handing it off to the next generation. Over 75% of the founding fathers of the vineyard will retire in the next 10 years. Well, when we were at the national conference, one of our speakers, who was a young guy, his name is Jay Pathak. He spoke, and he mentioned this passage. And as he looked at this generation, he said, "We are this generation. We live in a time of relative peace, and we don't have a battle in front of us." And I sat there, and I was just stunned because of this series that we've been in. And I went, "Jay, I totally agree with you. We are this generation, or at least we're in danger of becoming this generation because we don't have a battle in front of us." With each passing generation, the percentage of Christians in America is decreasing. It may well be that with each generation, we have become more and more complacent with spreading the gospel. We are losing the battle in front of us and failing to complete the assignment, just like the Israelites. We have been willing to settle for less than what God has for us and live a life of ease and comfort. Because we haven't had a battle in front of us, we have given in to the culture and the gods around us, just like Israel. Everything from the Jesus is just one of many gods. I'm just going to add Jesus to my smorgasbord of things that I believe in, to the more subtle, what's in it for me. I don't want to do hard things and make following Jesus easy. We have also lost that sense that we're in this battle together, in community, in family. Our Western individualism is destroying the church. We have given in to the attitude of the world around us that we'll just go wherever we go and call that following the Spirit. Just like the Israelites had many false gods in the land to choose from, so we Christians are running after all kinds of false gods of culture, gods of our own understanding, and gods of ease and comfort, because we don't want to have a battle in front of us. Let me give you a negative example and a very positive example. Oftentimes, people will come to me and complain about something. Sometimes people will come and complain, "You know, Tim, I don't really like this church anymore. It's too small." I'm like, "Well, great. Go out, gather some people, invite some friends, bring them in." And you know what they respond with? "No, that's not my thing. It's too hard." I cannot tell you how many times I've been told that. "It's too hard. That's not my thing." Really? Inviting people into the kingdom is not your thing? Huh. But here's a positive example. As you heard, our youth spent this week at Common Ground. On Friday, I saw this post. Jason Patrick is the leader of the Common Ground event. He heads up the whole thing, and he posted this on Facebook. "We canceled the outreach this morning because of the nonstop rain. It looked like it would clear up, but by 1 p.m. it was still raining and cold. So I told the students, we can stay here and be comfortable, or we can go out, get soaked, be cold, and share God's love even when it's not easy. We had 1,500 bottles of water left, double what we typically hand out on an outreach. It rained. We got wet and we got cold. No one stayed behind. All the water was gone. These teens are amazing." They get it. We put a battle before them and they rose to the occasion. They went out in the cold, pouring rain Friday afternoon and handed out 1,500 bottles of water. Kudos to you guys. That's having a battle in front of you. We put the battle in front of them and they rose to the occasion. At the national conference, Phil Strout, the new national director of the Vineyard, talked a lot about being all in. In fact, I was going to wear my all-in t-shirt today, and I forgot. At the national level, Phil meant that is holding on to the best of our past while keeping our eyes on the promises of the kingdom and pressing on toward the future, all in. We are determined as a movement to be the first movement to ever take revival from one generation to the next. He meant that is moving the Vineyard forward in racial diversity, all in, every tribe and tongue. That's what the church is supposed to look like. He meant that is keeping all ages engaged in the mission, including the children and the youth and all we do, and asking the older generations not to check out after retirement, but to circle back in and mentor the younger people so that we don't have a generation that grows up without knowing the Lord or the things that he has done. At the national conference, there was something like 1,500, or maybe it was even more than that. I'd have to ask Amy. There was at least 1,500 children, little children. And Phil goes, I want you to know how important they are to us. He had every single child, 1,500 of them, come up on stage and walk across the stage so that he could bless each one of them. And we stood there with our arms extended for an hour, and we blessed them all. As a local church, I'm looking for people who are all in. A people who are willing to do the hard things. Let's set a battle before us and go after it. Let us not fall into the generation that neither knew God nor the things he did. Let's be a part of the generation that picks the baton up of our forefathers in the Vineyard and carries revival on to the next generation and the generation after that. I'm looking for people who are willing to go out and get soaked in the rain and hand out water bottles and not say, just make it easy for me, Pastor. Phil, our new national director, uses this expression. He says, if it's worth anything, then it's worth everything. If we're going to commit to this gospel and to his church, then we have to be all in. We have to understand that if it's worth anything, it's worth everything. So what is our battle? What's our battle? Well, I see it as being two primary things. Number one, making the gospel known. This is going back to completing the assignment. Jesus gave us this assignment. The last thing he said to us before he rose is he says, take this gospel and go to all the nations. Right? It's at the end of Matthew. So the last thing that Jesus tells us is to take the gospel to the nations. We haven't completed that assignment yet. And so we're in danger of becoming the generation like the Israelites because we haven't completed the battle. We haven't completed the assignment. Partly because we've created, especially in the American church, we've created this professional clergy mentality. Well, that's the pastor's job. And if you don't believe me, then answer the question, when was the last time you shared your faith with someone? Are you all in to make the gospel known? If it's worth anything, it's worth everything. And the second thing as I see is our battle before us. Jesus said it over and over and over again. I call it advancing the kingdom of God on earth. But Jesus said, heal the sick, cleanse the leper, cast out demons, and raise the dead. We haven't finished that assignment yet. Being naturally supernatural and kingdom-minded in all we do. Diane Lehman also spoke at the National Convention, and she shared this powerful story. Diane and Happy pastor the Urbana Vineyard down in southern Illinois. And I think they have 6 children. But when they first got married, they were told by doctors that they would never have any children. And they tried for years, and they couldn't. Until somebody finally laid hands on them and prayed for them, and they started having children, and they had 6. Well, way back when those children were small, there was one day when Diane got up and she looked at her house. Most of their children are boys. I think they only have 1 girl. And the boys were all football players. One of them played in the NFL. She looks at her house and there's just chaos. She goes, there's just football gear. There's helmets and pads and cleats and mud and clothes. And there's just junk all over my house. And I kind of went to the Lord. Oh, gosh. Lord, does it have to be this way? And the Lord gave her an open-eyed vision of the house being perfectly spotless, perfectly clean, perfectly quiet, perfectly empty. And he goes, well, this is your option. And she repented before the Lord and thanked him for the mess. If we're going to be a naturally supernatural people, it's going to be messy. But our option is to be a dull, dead church that worships the paint on the wall. But if we're going to be all in for his kingdom and advancing the kingdom and completing the battle that Jesus gave us, then guess what? We have to go out and we actually have to heal the sick and cleanse the leper and cast out demons and raise the dead. And it's not just my job. He gave that commission to everyone who would call his name and follow him. But there's a problem when we just stay stuck here in our holy huddle. There's a limit to how many people are sick and have demons and have leprosy and are dead. To actually heal the sick and cleanse the leper and cast out demons, we have to go out there and find those people. But that's the assignment that he's given. And if we fail to complete this assignment, then we have sealed the deal that our children will raise up as a generation that neither knew God nor his deeds. Because they have to see us doing it if they're going to do it. And we have to take them with us as we do it. So the way I see it, we have two options. As we look at the lessons we've learned throughout this series on promise, and as we've looked at how they ended, with promise being only for one generation, we have two options. Live a life of quiet ease, comfortable and boring, but succumbing more and more to the world around us, or to go all in for the kingdom of Jesus and his church, finishing the assignment before us and remembering that promise is for all time. I'm in. Are you?